This is One Bills Live, presented by Kaleida Health.
All right, how the heck you doing here on a Tuesday? Chris Brown, Steve Tasker with you, One Bills Live, back in the saddle. Good to be back after a little hiatus there. I'm not going to lie, I had to get out of the weather.
Yeah.
I had to do it. I couldn't take it anymore.
You really missed out because we had 6 hours of sunshine over the weekend. You had no part of it, so...
Yeah, I think I did all right on the sunshine quota,
but no doubt.
It was good just to get out of the weather a little bit. I missed the earthquake, though.
Wow, yeah.
How about that?
That was a real thing. Yeah.
I saw some footage online and stuff because I was checking, you know, I got cameras at my house. So I was like, oh, let me check the house. Like, what's going on?
Did anything tipped over or anything? Any noticeable?
No.
It was bad.
I mean, I'm in Lancaster, and what was it? West Seneca was
the
epicenter.
Yeah, you were closer than I was. Maybe.
Probably like 8 miles.
Yeah, it was a big deal. It was a big deal.
It looked like it was one big bang, though.
It came through like that, yeah. It came through like that, and it sounded to me, and I said this yesterday, it sounded like a big explosion off in the distance, because you heard it, and you're up. What was that?
Yeah.
It was, you couldn't, like... I guess some people did miss it. Like, my son was on a bike or a Peloton or whatever, so he didn't feel it, go through. Like, so there was a ways you could miss it depending on how far away you are and what the situation was in your house. But if you were, like, it was 6:16 in the morning.
Yeah, shake you out of bed.
Laying in bed, yeah, you couldn't miss it. Mm. You couldn't miss it.
Yeah, I mean, from the footage I saw, it looked like it was just one really – like, maybe there was some rumbling, but then there was a bang, like a...
Yeah.
And the tweet that I laughed at when I was cruising around social media to find anybody that had footage, this guy says, you know you live in Buffalo when you have an earthquake and you think, was that the snowplow?
Right. That's
right.
Did
the snowplow hit somebody's mailbox or a tree
what
or
happened?
A lamppost?
Sound like a plow or something, yeah. We've all been there. I mean, yeah, so it's that's true. You knew something happened. Yeah. I said I was looking for a fireball. I thought a plane went down or a gas truck went off.
Yeah.
The end of the world coming, you know, off in the distance. I don't know. It was too big to be ignored.
Yeah.
Too big to be ignored.
But it was fast, right? You're talking, what, 10 seconds?
Not even.
Yeah.
For me, it felt like it was two or three.
Yeah.
Tops. And it, because like I said, felt like an impact. So it was gone.
Yeah.
Crazy stuff.
And I think we have a seismology center over at UB.
Like, yeah.
So they probably measured that.
What was the
quick.
Final number? Somebody, Canada
3.8,
said.
3.8, I think.
Canada said it was 4.2. We said it was 3.8, something in there. But it was, and it was.
Well, they do use the metric system. So.
Yeah, well, it's the exchange rate. The. From what I've heard, they're also all the people, the geology community is thinking is because of the Turkey earthquake that sent rumbles around the world.
Like literally through the earth to the other side?
Or around the crust.
Like a ripple.
Yes, like a ripple effect. I saw an animation of where the seismologies, seismographs were stationed throughout the world, and you could see the wave come across at the time.
No kidding. Wow.
And it was a big, and if you haven't seen it, it's pretty horrific what happened in Turkey.
Oh, yeah, it is. It's bad.
And it was a horrible tragedy.
Those building collapses are
but
awful.
It was a result of that, and it was, you know.
That
we,
makes
we
sense.
We got our part of it.
That makes sense, because you see tsunamis, you know.
Yeah,
for the
and we're not even on the edge of a fault here, you know.
Not to my knowledge.
No, I mean,
there may be a small one up here,
but not like the San Andreas or something you hear about.
No,
but. You know, so it would take something like that to have that happen here.
Taking me back to my days of earth science and plate tectonics. Remember earth science?
Look at you, plate tectonics.
Oh, I can't tell you anything else after that.
There was.
I remember what it was called.
Right. Right. But that's, you know, where we're at. So, yeah, you did miss that.
I did.
Were you in the air, like flying back, or did you just not feel it down there?
What was that, Sunday or Monday morning?
Yesterday morning.
Yeah, I was still on the ground. But, yeah.
Yeah.
That was wild. Wild, wild, wild. Because you don't have that here very often.
You missed it.
I'm trying to think. Like, I want to say there was one, like a little minor shaker, like 15, 20 years ago or something, but I'm be hard-pressed to remember exactly if that's right or not. I don't know why that's sticking in my head, but I could be completely off on that. When I was a teenager, I remember I got shook out of bed down on Long Island, and that was a longer one. That was like 15, 20 seconds. Like, my lamp on my nightstand was shaking, and it was rattling, and that's how I was. And then the bed's kind of going, like, shaking a little bit. That was the only one I've been through, so.
Yeah.
Certainly not like those major ones they have out west. So they can, and they can have them. Quite frankly, I don't need any of that stuff. You can have all of that. I'll take the snow here any day of the week. You can have your tornadoes, your earthquakes, your mudslides, your hurricanes. I'll take the snow any day of the week. So yeah, but crazy that it happened, because it doesn't, as we said, it doesn't happen that often around here. Earlier this morning, Jessie Pegula, daughter of Terry and Kim Pegula, the pro tennis player, had a written, kind of like an open letter type thing, on the Players Tribune. We've seen Deion Dawkins participate in that space. Jordan Poyer was very open about his alcoholism in that space. And so Jessica Pegula put together a piece that said, "I want to talk to you about my mom." And it basically outlines all of the progress that Kim has made since she unfortunately sustained cardiac arrest, and just some amazing details provided by Jesse, you know, because the family understandably has chosen to keep things private, but Jesse felt she had to get this off her chest. And I mean, it was very well written, very well laid out, not only in terms of what has happened to their mom, but I think more importantly, I thought it very effectively encapsulated what the family has been dealing with for almost a year now, just with Kim's recovery and everything that's been involved in that. So just some really telling things that just make you feel the weight of what they've been dealing with.
I've had conversations with had a conversation with Terry about, you know, some of the things that and let's face it, Kim and Terry, you know, bought the Bills, bought the Sabres, and you get a lot of things when you buy a business. Sometimes you get a lot of stuff you don't sign up for, and one of the things you don't sign up for is that people, right or wrongly, whatever your position is on, and I'm not going to take sides now, but they think like you're kind of public property. And the thing that they forget is how much of a family the Pegulas are. They're great. Kim, Terry, their kids, they've all been great. And they when you get to, you know, when you get in behind that, they're a loving family. And they wanted to handle this like a family wants to. They don't want everybody to know what's going on. They didn't want to be a public conversation. And it took months and months before, you know, Jessie felt like she was in the position, and I'm sure she, you know, got the blessings from her family to let everybody know what had happened, and kudos to them for handling it as well as they have. But we all feel for them. So happy to know that Kim is on the mend, and that there are better days ahead for all of them, and we wish their family the best, because that's I guess my point is that you forget that they're a family and they're not celebrities. They're not public figures really per se. They own a very prominent business. So the things you get sometimes that you don't sign up for aren't all that attractive sometimes, and they've handled it extremely well. So good for them. We'll continue to keep them in our prayers, and kudos to them for how they have handled this from now starting to
right.
finished.
And we, you know, among the details that we found was Kim's other daughter, Kelly, essentially performed CPR on Kim, which was, I mean, basically Jessie credits her sister with, you know, saving her mom's life. It's dramatic, dramatic stuff. I mean, it was a heavy read, and Kim is dealing, as Jessie points out, with aphasia, expressive aphasia, which is when cognitively you know everything that's going on, whether you're having a conversation with somebody or you're interacting with another person, But the words don't always come to you to express whatever response you have in mind. So it's not considered a cognitive problem. It's a language problem. And, you know, that's what she's been working on from what we understand based on what Jesse has said in terms of, you know, getting back to a place where, you know, she can, you know, conduct conversations like she always has. You know, whether she'll ever get to that point, you know, will remains to be seen. I guess the best news is that she's making daily and weekly progress. So we wish her the best on that course and hope she does get to her goal, which is probably carrying on conversations just as she always had. So our best wishes again to the family on that as they're, you know, this is anytime a family's dealing with a health issue, it always weighs on you heavily, which is what struck me. You know, Jesse mentioned one thing when they say one day in the hospital equals a week to recover. That is no joke. And she's talking about everybody that's dealing with the sick person or the unhealthy person. It's the other family members that are there supporting that person that are mentally and physically exhausted just from stress, worry, time spent, you know, sleeping in a chair in a hospital room. That's the stuff that wears out the people that are trying to be there for their family members. So that's why I felt, you know, Jesse did such a good job encapsulating everything.
Yeah, and as as we've said, now at least, and because there's been a ton of people, you know, sending their thoughts and their prayers to the Pegula family. Now they can know the details and be more specific in those thoughts and prayers. So good. So we're all in a better spot, maybe perhaps today than we were.
Right. So, again, as Steve said, you know, we continue to pass our well wishes on to the Pegula family, not just Kim, but all those people that have been carrying this, like Jesse, which is why she had to get it off her chest, and we totally understand why. And just amazing the year that she's had in tennis despite all of this. Is that unbelievable? It's unbelievable.
It happened right when she cracked the top 10. She climbed all the way to number 3 during this time. So that's been awesome to see. It's made me a tennis fan. So she's been thriving and doing well in the midst of a great hardship.
That's tough.
I just say, but much like the city of Buffalo has. So it's
well,
it's
yeah, and yeah. You know that's what brought it all full circle for the Pegula family when the Damar Hamlin thing happened, because it was pretty comparable to what they experienced in their own family, mm-hmm. And now it happens in the extended family with Damar. I can't imagine. What was running through Terry Pegula's head that night in Paycor Stadium in Cincinnati. It's got to be crazy. So, yeah, the good news is both parties are on the mend. So we just hope that continues going forward. We want to get to NFL news and notes, so we go around the NFL now, which is presented by Kaleida Health, the official healthcare system of the Buffalo Bills. And we begin with the Minnesota Vikings, Steve, who now have a new defensive coordinator in Brian Flores, now a former Steelers defensive assistant and former Dolphins head coach. I think this is a good hire for Minnesota. They needed help on defense, Steve. That's the thing that cost them their season. They were 31st in total defense, 28th in points allowed.
You can say what you want, and may be true. They didn't have, you know, great personnel, but I don't think they had the 31st worst defensive roster in the league. Mm. You know, certainly they weren't the Philadelphia Eagles or the San Francisco 49ers or even the Buffalo Bills, but they were better than 31st in the league.
That was pretty bad.
And so Brian Flores, who is a highly respected leader and a defensive mind and former head coach, obviously, of the Dolphins, is going to go there. I think that's a great hire for Minnesota. A great hire for Minnesota.
With Flores taking that job as defensive coordinator with the Vikings, it takes him out of the job for the Cardinals head coaching post, which now is down to two candidates. It's essentially Giants OC Mike Kafka and Bengals defensive coordinator Lou Anarumo. So those are the only two guys left for that job.
Yeah. Are we cheering for Anarumo to go to the, well, out of the conference?
Yeah,
I mean, we are. He's a really good defensive coordinator, and you know you're going to end up playing the guy. if he's in the AFC with Cincinnati. Are you surprised, Brownie, because I know we'll get to it in a minute, maybe we will, that the Cardinals are still without a head coach, and so are the Indianapolis Colts?
Yeah, there is a part of me.
This is not a usual time frame to get these guys hired.
Yeah, there's a part of me that's wondering if there's someone from the two Super Bowl teams' staffs that Arizona might be interested in, but I would have thought they would have interviewed him already.
Yeah, who? I mean,
I don't know. I mean, you can go down the Eric Bieniemy path again. I'm just throwing out names here. So,
yeah.
You know, I don't know. Could be anybody. You know, the Eagles staff, I mean, there's people there. I was just wondering, like, what could be the holdup? And that, to me, might be one of the only things I can think of, that maybe there's somebody on one of those staffs that they want to talk to.
And I'm not even familiar enough with down deep. Eric Bieniemy, we've been hearing about for a couple of years. I don't even know who on the Eagles staff. I don't even know their coordinators at this point to know who's been doing, because I hate to say it, but I get it. Nick Sirianni's getting a lot of credit for what's going on in Philly, but man, oh man, they got some horses over there.
Yeah, I mean, the DC, Jonathan Gannon, was mentioned in certain places, and he's a young guy. So too is their OC, Shane Steichen, who was working in L.A. with the Chargers, then moved on to the Eagles with Sirianni. I know their offensive line coach, Jeff Stoutland, has been interviewed for a couple of coordinator positions because he's only an offensive line coach / run game coordinator. But to my knowledge, you know, they're not hiring people away from Super Bowl teams. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know who. It was just a guess because we're waiting a long time here,
right,
for this to come together. And I, you know, I'm sure there are other things that could hold it up. You could have something as simple as, you know, contract language. Maybe somebody's agreed to terms and
right,
they're trying to cross T's and dot I's. That could be it. I know that you were always curious about whether or not Arizona could lure an offensive coach to come in to work with Kyler Murray. And right now you've got Kafka, the OC from the Giants, as the only offensive candidate. And then obviously Anarumo, who's, you know, a defensive-minded guy, as the other candidate. So, yeah, what are they waiting for? You got me. I don't know. I don't know what's keeping them from finalizing that.
And I'm not saying it's the reason, but it fuels the speculation that I've made over the course of the last couple month or two that there are some guys who know thank you these jobs. Certainly there's a certain level of guys who would take it for any reason, they would love it. But there's a lot of guys, you know, guys like Sean Payton, who just took the Denver job. You could see a coach of his stature say no to something, but I think that line drops down even into some pretty good coordinator spots where these guys say, I want to take a job where I can be successful in, because if I go, I'm gonna have this job for 3 or 4 years, and we're gonna stink, and I'm gonna be fired, and then what am I gonna do?
Take a step back.
Yeah, then I'm gonna take a step back, and then I'm back to coordinating again or whatever. I think there's a number of, or at least at any given point in the NFL, it changes obviously from year to year, where there's guys who will say, I don't know.
Yeah.
Particularly the prominent candidates.
I realize this is kind of an obvious point, but I kind of thought all along that the Cardinals were going to have to hire a first-time head coach, because getting some of these veteran guys to say yes to what I see as a tenuous situation.
Did you catch,
I just don't see it.
Did you catch the Sean Payton remarks about Russell Wilson?
Oh, yeah.
See, so Russell Wilson, Russell Wilson had an office in the Broncos facility, and his personal coach was there. Now, I don't know whether the guy was a coach or whether he was an assistant.
No, he wasn't on the staff. He came and go as he pleased.
I know. He said he was a coach, but I don't know whether he was an personal assistant or whether he was this guru a mechanics coach
he'll
or a nutrition.
After practice.
What do I care? I don't even know if the guy was a nutritionist or what. He might have been, you know, I don't know. But he was in the building, and he was Russell. He was on Russell's pay, you know,
payroll,
not the Broncos' payroll. So at his introductory press conference, Sean Payton was asked about Russ's personal coach. And he said, basically, he said, yeah, that's not going to fly. It's going to be us, our players, and our staff, and that's going to be all who's in the building. So Sean Payton just fired Russell's entire staff.
Well, at least he's preventing access to the building.
So
the guy will not be in the building.
So we heard some stuff this last season when Russ, you know, he had fewer touchdown passes than bathrooms in his new house. We heard, you know, that kind of thing. So Russ was flexing a little bit in the building, I think. And Sean Payton's coming in saying, no, that's
yeah, we're not doing that.
Yeah. Which is, I think, an absolutely proper and 100% correct move to make.
Payton's former team, the Saints, hired a new defensive coordinator in Joe Woods, who was fired at season's end in Cleveland. Woods, not a bad deal to walk into. He's inheriting a top-five defense that finished 9th in points allowed. Cleveland, the defense he coordinated, was 14th in total defense. And, you know, 12th against the pass, 20th in points allowed. Browns couldn't stop the run last year. They were 25th against the run, but that was also a problem in New Orleans. They were 24th against the run, not much better. Hard to know what that defense is going to look like, knowing the Saints are about $57 million over the cap. And I also read this. Head coach Dennis Allen is going to be calling the plays on defense. So the scheme remains, and Joe Woods comes in, and he's just going to be holding a clipboard. He's not even going to be calling the plays
on
defense.
Well, he'll probably be – he's going to be doing more than that. But, yeah, on game day, he probably will have a voice in what's going on, but not be calling the plays. For instance, game planning is an ongoing process. He's going to be neck deep in that for sure.
Right.
And personnel decisions, all of that stuff. Dennis Allen, though, will be calling the plays. And that's – I get that. I'm all about that. I think a head coach should be calling the offensive plays or calling the defensive plays. You know why?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Why?
Because, for instance, say this is the way it is in Kansas City, Andy Reid. If Eric Bieniemy is calling the plays and he gets all this credit for how good this offense is – pretty soon he's coaching the Arizona Cardinals or the Indianapolis Colts or the Carolina Panthers. Well, now you got to find another guy. But if your head coach is doing that, at least you have your play caller.
Somebody there who
you're not going to get totally gutted. Your offensive coordinator goes there to coach. Your defensive coordinator goes there to coach. Now we were in the AFC Championship game or the Super Bowl this year. Now we can't get back because I got to redo the top of my entire staff. So I'm all about having a head coach on game day, having some important responsibilities so that he doesn't lose those guys to hires when the team becomes successful. So I see the value in that, particularly in Kansas City where you got Pat Mahomes and you don't want that guy. And we here the Buffalo's done it. Now you can make the comment now. People are saying, well, I don't know Ken Dorsey, I don't know listen. They were better offensively this year than they were last year.
Against a harder strength of schedule.
Against a much more difficult strength of schedule and more injuries. So you can say what you want about it. You don't like Ken Dorsey. You think he should be fired. How the season ended and all that stuff. You can say what you want. They were better this year than they were last year. They were number two scoring, number two
total offense.
Total points, number two scoring, number two yards get. And they were the best team, number one team on third down. Say whatever you want. They were better this year than they were last year. That doesn't always happen. And you may not like the way it looks.
Well, especially with the first-time play caller coming in.
Right. You may not like the way it looks. You think, wow, they should have been better. They should have been. Listen, they were better than they were the year before in their rankings and in a lot of ways. So you may not like it to hear it, and you may be bummed about it, but Ken Dorsey did a really nice job, and he's still here. Which is good, but what happens now? You got to do it again. Now, what's going to happen? Joe Brady going to move up again? You're going to, you know, pretty soon you run out of guys who have the continuity and the experience to help Josh.
Yeah.
So this year they got away with it, in, if you want to say it that way, in losing a great coordinator like Daboll. But it doesn't always happen like that.
Yeah.
You may be right. Maybe Philly and Kansas City are going to get pillaged after the Super Bowl with these hires, with these two head coaching hires that are still out there. Maybe not.
Yeah, maybe not.
But the still simple fact of the matter is, you know, it's a thing. The staffs are vastly important in the NFL. And if you keep having to replace guys at the top, man, it's a problem. So I like that having defensive guys like Doug Allen in New Orleans. I get it. I totally get it.
Yeah. There is more coaching news that just happened. Former Panthers interim head coach Steve Wilks is expected to become the new defensive coordinator of the San Francisco 49ers. They had a vacancy, obviously, when D'Amico Ryans left to become the head coach of the Texans. So Steve Wilks will be the new DC in San Francisco. He actually has been a head coach in his previous coaching career. He was the one-and-done guy in Arizona right after they drafted Josh Rosen and then was summarily dismissed after one season, and Cliff Kingsbury came in and really didn't have a whole lot more success. So looks like Wilks will be going to San Fran to work under Kyle Shanahan with the 49ers. That's a heck of a defense to inherit.
Yeah,
that's not a bad gig.
Yeah, that's.
I know they got to pay Nick Bosa this offseason.
I'll say this, though, too. I mean, it's you're going to get scrutinized because they were really good,
yeah,
and they better be really good this year, or it's on you. You know what I'm saying? There
right.
better be some.
And they were number one, so there's
right.
only one place they can go.
You better be. There better be some really obvious reasons other than you that they don't live up to the number one defense again next year.
Mm-hmm.
You better have some real solid, tangible reasons that everybody can see, or you're going to get the blame for them dropping in the rankings. But there's no better, you know, you don't have a, nobody's got a cupboard that's more full than yours is.
Yeah.
Walking into that. So I'll see. We'll see. I think that comes with a lot of pressure. A lot like Ken Dorsey's pressure coming in with Brian Daboll this year. He did well.
Right. And an all-world quarterback. Topic of discussion today concerns that quarterback, Josh Allen. What do you believe is the most effective way to take the load off Josh Allen next season? I think there's a lot of people, fans and outside observers alike, who would claim that there is too much on Josh Allen's plate and too much of the offensive burden falls on him too much of the time. Just look at his rushing yards as one example. So, in your eyes, what is the most effective way, roster-wise, for the Bills to take the load off Josh Allen next season? You tell us at 803-0550, 1-888-550-2550, the number to get on board. Got an open line for you there. Or you can hit us up on the tweet sheet at 1BillsLive. We've heard, you know, we have Greg Cosell on here on a weekly basis during the season, Steve, and he says, he said it more than once. He feels that the offense is too Josh-centric and too much of the burden is on him to make it all work every single week, no matter the circumstances.
Yeah.
And I think he's got a point. And, you know, I think that's why a lot of us feel like the team's got to go all in on the offensive side of the ball this offseason to kind of surround him with a little bit more to work with.
We had this conversation, too, that – in the AFC Championship game, Mahomes and Joe Burrow, Mahomes almost set records. He was 91% of their offense. So if you've got that guy, which the Bills do, the Chiefs do, the Chargers do, the Bengals do, you can go down the list, I think you got to ride that horse. And you got to expect him to be that guy. Now, if you can make him, give him help, no question it's going to help. I mean, it's going to
make it easier for him.
And a lot of things point towards it. The rules are slanted towards that side of the ball. They officiate towards that side of the ball. That position gets a ton of protection where you don't have to worry about getting clotheslined two steps after the ball's left your hand. They protect it. everything says that if you've got that guy, it should be easy for him. And it didn't seem like that for Josh this year. It seemed like it was at times, it was like, man, give the guy a little help. You know, do a little something. Somebody do something. So I think that's where a lot of Bills fans kind of find themselves at different times. Maybe not all the time, but certainly at different times, Bills fans are like, well, man, don't drop that pass, you know. Or hand
we,
the ball.
Can we help him out?
Can you hand it to him instead of letting Josh run for the fourth and one? Can you hand it to somebody else? That kind of thing. So that's where we're at today with the question.
Yeah.
How would you do it?
Yeah. Most effective way to take the load off of Josh next season. Not saying you're going to have him take a back seat. He's still going to be the driving force of the offense. But how do you make things a little easier for him with respect to the roster? You let us know at 803-0550. We take a break here, but we're back with your phone calls and your tweets next. Here on One Bills Live, presented by Kaleida Health, this is Buffalo Bills Radio. All right, welcome back to One Bills Live. Chris Brown, Steve Tasker with you as we are discussing what you think the most effective way to take the load off Josh Allen next season might be. Plenty of ways to do it, and Steve and I kind of gave our initial feelings earlier before we went to break. We want to know what you think at 803-0550, 1-888-550-2550, open line for you there. But we go to the phones now, and leading us off is Dan in Glenwood. What do you got for us, Dan? You're on One Bills Live.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. So I was going to say what we needed to add was two simple words, reliable targets. But I want to go one step further and say push the chips to the middle of the table and go all in on reliable targets for Josh. Don't just do it in the draft because McDermott's kind of shown he's afraid to eat players as an integral part of the offense. We still don't know what we have in Khalil Secure. And we can't count on 100% free agency we're going to be able to get, but come right at it from all fronts.
So
Darnell Washington, that 6'7" tight end out of Georgia, you know, in the draft.
Yeah.
There's been reports the Chargers are going to move on from Keenan Allen due to cap space. Maybe he'd be willing to take a more team-friendly deal, somebody like that.
So why don't you give me a number, Dan, in turn? So reliable targets, plural, but what would be a sufficient number for you? And you can lump receivers, tight ends all together. What would be a total over-under number you'd be looking at to satisfy you?
New additions?
Correct.
Three.
Okay.
You would need, like I said, maybe one from the draft to get some youth, one free agent-wise, but you'd have to have one other one to compensate for injuries or busts. And then you hope one of the other pieces we have turns the corners. We do have something in Shakir. It clicks for Gabe Davis. Knox becomes just a little bit more dependable, something like that.
Gotcha.
So
gotcha.
Three additions.
So there is that you think one of the additions out of the three you're talking about are already on the roster, but you got to find them and develop them.
I would hope either way.
Yeah.
If it's not Shakir, if it's not Davis, then maybe there was an underrated lower cost free agent acquisition we made in addition to DeAndre Hopkins, Keenan Allen. I think is T. Higgins going to be a free agent, or is he in a contract year or something with Cincinnati?
No.
He is the same as Joe Burrow, so I think he has a year left on his original rookie deal. As you know, after year three, if the quarterback's shown up, they sign him sooner rather than later to a monster extension. They're probably going to have to wait on Higgins another year, and if they don't pay him, then he'll hit free agency next year.
Yeah, but he's not an option for next season. Yeah.
No, probably not. No.
Somebody like that. We can't afford multiple big names, but you would hope you could get a big name and a promising draft prospect, and then maybe a bargain free agent signing and or one of our guys we currently have on the roster clicking. So we would need three total out of that.
Yeah. All right. Good call, Dan. Thanks for it. 803-0550, number to get on board, 1-888-550-2550. We move along, and we go to Mark in West Seneca next. What do you got for us, Mark?
Hi, guys. Chris, welcome back. You're missed.
Thanks.
I think everybody is going so crazy over – I got two things I wanted to mention real quick. What we need to do on offense to help Josh. And then I just wanted to make a comment on always talking about where are we rank statistically, offensively and defensively. So real quick, I believe with Diggs, Davis, Knox, what the role that Cook is going to have next year – I think Morris is a more than serviceable other option at tight end. He can help a lot. I think you got Shakir. And if they add one more a wide receiver in the first round, somebody that has the potential to be dynamic if they can find him where they're going to be drafting from, I think, and then you re-sign Crowder, I think you may be okay. I think we really need to invest in the offensive line. I would like to see first-round wide receivers, second, third-round offensive linemen, and then pick, try to bring in a couple of veteran guys on the offensive line for a reasonable amount of money if they could. I really think you really help your offense a lot by really solidifying that offensive line. And I think we can't overlook that because we're so in search of weapons. So that's the first thing I'd like to say. The other thing I'd like to say really quick is we always point to the standings of where our offense and defense finishes up. We're top five offense. We're top five defense, blah, blah, blah. And as significant as that is and as important as that is, it's reflective of the regular season. And we look at the end of the year where we get eliminated in the division and AFC playoffs the last 3 years. And if you look at our performances of our offense and defense, three out of those years defensively, we were nowhere near up to a top five defense. If you look at the production and how we played, and two of those 3 years was the same thing offensively. My point is this: we can't overlook the performance of what's going on at the end of the year when the competition gets great, because we do so well during the offense during the regular season. We can't let that overshadow it. We need to make hard decisions and find out where the disconnect is between how we perform regular season and playoffs. And obviously the competition is a lot harder, so you're maybe not going to perform as well, but we can't have a drop-off like we've had for 3 years now.
So, yeah, I get you. And that's good. It's a point well made, Mark, and I get it, particularly about the rankings and how they're at the end of the season. I've said a lot, and you know nobody really wants to hear it, but the Bills, their roster, their players, their coaches have been good enough and talented enough to win the Super Bowl for the last 3 years. And they haven't gotten it done on those crucial days. They got close. They got to the 13-second mark to get to the AFC Championship game, which would have been in Buffalo. They got to the AFC Championship game against Kansas City, and Kansas City admittedly played their best game of that season in 2020 against the Bills in the championship game. You have to play well. You're right. Statistics don't matter. You got to play well on game day in the playoffs or you lose. And the Bills have been a victim of that over the last 3 years, that final game. They haven't played well enough. You can say what you want about a 13-second game. They still gave that team, let them off the hook. And they went to the AFC Championship game and hosted it. They subsequently lost it, but you got to know that the Bills, it would have been a different game against Cincinnati. Maybe the Bengals would have beaten the Bills in Buffalo like they did the Chiefs in Kansas City. But you surely would have loved to have a swing at that. You're right. You got to play well on game day in the playoffs. All the stats you've accumulated, all the good things that you've done through the year don't mean anything on that game because you got to play. And you're playing usually, or at least in a couple of, you play a team that you haven't seen for a long time. Now, it would have been different in Cincinnati because of the Monday night game and the fact that it didn't happen. But it didn't happen. So, you're right. That's a problem. And I'm willing to listen to, although we were here in the exact same spot last year with Diggs, Davis, Knox, Morris, McKenzie, and at that time it was Hodgins was here. We had all these guys. Hey, these guys are going to be good. You know, Davis ended on a high note. Diggs is going to be good again. Knox is going to take another step forward. We're kind of right
Knox
there.
Knox was coming off a 9-touchdown season.
And Mark from West Seneca, you're saying you believe in him again with Shakir and Cook added to that mix. You're thinking that they are good. And I'm kind of with you.
You better have some insurance.
They scored a ton of points this year. They scored a ton of points this year and had a lot of yards. And you add Crowder to the mix, he was playing well. I went back and watched some games. Crowder was really helping before he broke his leg. Okay, well, he'll be back, and if you'd sign him back, that'd be great. But with Shakir and Morris, another year under their belt, yeah, maybe they will be helping a little bit more, no question about it. I'm kind of with you at the bottom line. I think this offseason's about the offensive line, drafting those guys, getting them in free agency. If you can run the ball better with those guys up front, if you've got a little bit more dominant physical presence up in the middle and on the at the tackles when those guys, you know, play well and stay healthy, yeah, everything changes for Josh and all those guys outside. So I'm kind of with you on that. I got to say, for most of that, I'm with you. I like the weapons we've got. They certainly scored enough points this last year to advance, but your second point is the one that's really relevant.
Yeah, and
you've got to do it in the playoffs.
And I've said this before, too. The Chiefs are a team that's a couple of years ahead of the Bills in terms of their build, their roster build. And certain things come due in terms of expenditures and player salaries ahead of – they're almost like a look ahead for what the Bills are going to encounter in a year or two. They experienced that at the quarterback position with the large, fat contract, you know, for the franchise quarterback and how you manipulate the roster after that and where you make sacrifices and where you invest. And what did they do 2 years ago to invest? They made a trade for their left tackle, Orlando Brown. They signed Joe Tooney at the top of the market at the guard position in free agency, and they drafted Creed Humphrey in the first round. And now they have one of the best offensive lines in the league because of it. Where did they sacrifice? On the defensive side of the ball the very next year. They didn't re-sign Charvarius Ward, a starting cornerback. They didn't bring back Tyrann Mathieu. They let him go to free agency. So there's a certain give and take that the Chiefs decided to make. They invested in their offense, in their line, and they replaced Tyreek Hill with a bunch of players instead of paying Tyreek Hill $30 million a year. They traded him away. The Bills are going to have to take that similar approach, I think, going forward, and the offensive line and the receiver position are two areas where that's going to have to happen. We got to take a break here, but more of your phone calls when we come back. What's the most effective way to take the load off Josh and make things easier for him next season? We take your phone calls. Next segment, here again on One Bills Live, presented by Kalida Health. This is Buffalo Bills Radio. All right, you got to tell us the most effective way to take the load off Josh Allen next season, by roster or otherwise. You let us know, 803-0550. Back to the phones we go, and we go to Roslyn in Buffalo. What do you got for us, Roslyn?
Hey, guys, how's it going today?
Good.
I'm just calling you from North Buffalo. Guys, you know, I've been watching football a long time. And from my perspective, you know, we drafted one of the best quarterbacks, Josh Allen, that we could have gotten in Buffalo. We really got lucky with him. From my perspective, he has not been given enough time for our plays to develop. That kid is running for his life. And you hit the nail right on the head before we went to break. Kansas City did the right thing. They invested in their offensive line. You know, we don't need big name, you know, football players. You saw what they did. Mm-hmm. So why can't we do the same thing? And this has been going on for a couple years. I mean, you know, yeah, we got Von Miller. We invested in our defense, but we didn't invest in our offensive line. Yeah, we've got Diggs. We've got all these guys. We don't need to create the wheel here. And then on defense, my comment on defense is, yeah, we do need help in our secondary. You know, I don't know what happened to the team. I mean, it just seemed like they ran out of steam, you know, at the end.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, we were hurt, but our guys came back. That Cincinnati game, when we found out that they had three players on their offense that weren't starters, we should have ran all over them. It seemed like we were in slow motion.
Yeah. And they, and you know, the Bills very quietly, I don't know how many people, and thanks for the call, Rosalind, we got to jump here. We've said this before, too. Yes, the Bengals were without three starting offensive linemen. The Bills were also without Daquan Jones in that game, who had played in every other game this season. logged the majority of the snaps at the one technique and was probably the best run stuffer on the team. And then you had Jordan Phillips playing with one arm with a torn rotator cuff. So,
and Von Miller was out.
And no Von Miller. So essentially you had three guys in the top six of their rotation for the Bills on the defensive side out. But your point about safety is well noted. I think that was the missing link in the secondary. Not having Micah Hyde since week two, Jordan Poyer in and out of the lineup, missing five or six games due to injury.
Damar Hamlin was out.
And then Damar Hamlin goes down.
Jaquan Johnson had started in place of Damar, and they made the switch. They moved to Damar from Jaquan Johnson early on after the injury.
There were times where both of them had to play.
And yeah.
Week three.
So you can make the case that Jaquan was like the third guy that would have been in there. So, yeah, the point's well taken.
Yeah, and also, Steve, I think we kind of got spoiled a little bit with the way Poyer and Hyde have worked together for the better part of the last five seasons. I mean, they covered up a lot and neutralized a lot of potential disasters. I mean, they were defusing bombs every week, but it was just they were so good at it. I think as onlookers, we almost took it for granted how effective they were in shutting things down.
I think if you can I know it's just a philosophical thing. If you can get more dominant offensively, you really put pressure on teams to keep up. And it's not easy to do. Even if your defense is I still think the secondary, when they're healthy, is going to be as good as anybody's. I think you put pressure on them from both sides of the football. But I think often the league is slanted towards that side of the ball. I don't think you can be deficient on offense. I mean, look at the season that the Detroit Lions had and the Minnesota Vikings had. They were at the top of the conference with a chance to go with a defense that was statistically poor, very poor. And yet they were ringing people up.
One more than they lost,
and they did it with a roster that preseason was thought to be middle of the road at best. So, and that's how the Lions finished up. But they're the flavor of the month.
They finished 9-8
with the season they had. Yeah. The Minnesota Vikings, it's an old story for them, but their defense was nothing to write home about.
Right, and they won 10 one-score games this year because their offense could finish at the end of football.
That's right. So I'm kind of with you. I want the offensive line to be big, bad, and young and cheap.
A little nasty, too.
Because I like the guys they have on the outside. Certainly, we had more drops than we liked, but they had guys that were getting separation. They had every so often, you know, guys make really nice catches. Diggs is as good as there is. Davis, I sometimes thought maybe just needs some more opportunities. Shakir, same thing. Cook, same thing. You know, I there's a lot there to like. And certainly the end of the season leaves a bad taste in everybody's mouth, but I'm not going to throw out a lot of really good football players just because the season ended on a sour note.
Yeah. We have to take a break here, but when we return, we are going to be joined by NFL Network analytics expert Cynthia Freeland. She'll be joining us here in hour number two to break some things down for us, including the upcoming Super Bowl. Cynthia Freeland coming your way next here on One Bills Live, presented by Kaleida Health. It's Buffalo Bills Radio.
Live, presented by Kaleida Health.
All right, here we are, hour number two on a Tuesday. Chris Brown, Steve Tasker with you. One Bills Live is the show, and pleased to be joined now by NFL Network's self-proclaimed numbers nerd. It is Cynthia Freeland joining us. How we doing, Cynthia? Good to see you here on this Super Bowl week.
so great to see you. I'm also, you know, Bills preseason. This is a big for me. I always never deny my Bills love there.
You were on the sidelines last week at the East-West Shrine game, too, after you did the preseason with us every year. That was, how'd that go?
So the actual Shrine week was epic. The actual game was a little slow. It was a little slow. I think it was funny because this year the Patriots were one coaching staff and the Falcons were the other. And it was just a different vibe than before when they had like pieced together staffs with like different from different teams. So just a different experience, but there's a lot of good players there. Some of them didn't play in the game, but they were at practice. So you did get a chance to see them there.
Yeah. That's a cool thing. And we're in that season now, like the whole pre-draft thing. And I know that's probably a little down the line for you with some of the, evaluations that you'll be doing and, crunching the analytics on those prospects. I did find, you had a piece back on championship weekend that I liked a lot. It was like one thing that each of the teams does better than the other kind of thing. I was still fascinated by it from the very jump with the Chiefs because not having Tyreek, I was really interested in how their offense was going to kind of morph and change because they're not going to be able to just throw him a pass and expect him to run 60 yards to pay dirt. So I guess it didn't shock me that their yards per attempt were down and their passing game was shorter by nature, but they made it work. Like I was surprised that it remained effective wire to wire here for them. Were you surprised by that?
I guess I was surprised to see that Patrick Mahomes had thrown the most touchdown passes of 10 or fewer air yards this season. Just because when you close your eyes and you think of Patrick Mahomes, you think of like horizontal passes going 30 yards from some weird arm angle that just doesn't make any sense. But he has 12 more touchdown passes than the next closest guy on those shorter distance passes. And it was interesting. And I know you're showing some, MVS highlights here. It's interesting to see who's had to pick up the yak. Like Marquez Valdes-Scantling did not have a real like after the catch situation when he was at his former team with the Packers, but they've moved Kelce around the formation. They've moved MVS. They've adapted when they got injured. You saw that last week with Kadarius Toney leaving early, especially, and no Juju Smith-Schuster. So it's been really interesting to see all of the different formations they've been running and how they've had to kind of adapt and make it happen so that you could still get Travis Kelce the ball.
Yeah, we've been talking about how these two teams were built in the Super Bowl, Philly and Kansas City. Mahomes famously signed that $500 million contract that is, he's going to be a Chief until he's 62. But but they've had to work around that contract and they've seemed to have done it. They got contributions from a lot of young guys and some cheap labor after bolstering an offensive line. I mean, they seem to have hit on a lot of cylinders.
Absolutely. And if you're looking in this upcoming game, I mean, L'Jarius Sneed, who just cleared concussion protocol, he'll be a free agent this season. So they're still getting him at pretty much a premium. I think he's shown a lot at that star position, the nickel corner position and out wide, actually. I think I don't know if they're going to be able to afford to keep him, but it'll be interesting to see, he's got a whole contract on the line. So that could be a big game from him, could mean a lot of money for another team.
There's a lot about the Eagles that is impressive this season, and obviously the addition of A.J. Brown says a lot. I think the quality of their lines on offense and defense is also something. But their short yardage success this year, Cynthia, not only on third down but on fourth down too, is uncanny. Like, we see that a lot here with Josh, and it's like, okay, he's a 6'5", 245-pound quarterback. Yeah, he's pretty much a sure thing on sneaks. But Jalen Hurts is like just as good, and he's like half of Josh's size. Like, what's going on there?
Well, part of the fact is it's the best O-line in football this season. So that, quite helpful thing to have happen there. Plus the addition of the way that they've kind of folded in or not folded in, strategically used the field stretching weapons as well as designed quarterback runs. I mean, we haven't actually even seen Hurts really do any designed runs since he hurt his shoulder, so well over a month. But if you're seeing like where he's been super effective and efficient, it's been like, kind of an issue where Miles Sanders doesn't pick up a block and he's like, well, got to go on my own. Miles Sanders didn't pick up the blitz, so I'm going to go scramble for my life now, which is just a different way from Josh. Josh just muscles it. Hurts just sort of bounces around and responds to it.
So in the next, and when you see these two teams match up, and the, you know, and the difference in the, you know, the way they're structured, you're right. It was the line of scrimmage has been Philadelphia's on both sides of the ball, and that's really been the engine that has driven them all season. Correct?
Absolutely. I mean, they had 70 sacks, so that's the most in the league by a lot. And, you know, they also were getting pressure without using the blitz, which is very helpful because you can drop guys in coverage. If there was one weakness or the area that, you know, Andy Reid will look to exploit, it's probably the linebacker level, especially linebackers in coverage and the safeties. And, you know, sometimes CJ Gardner-Johnson plays safety, so I'm excluding him from that. But, you know, the safeties other than him, because if you see the area of the field that has been most targeted, they have almost a 58 completion percentage allowed in that back middle third of the field, which is kind of like the Travis Kelce area. So that's where I would think that Andy Reid would look to exploit, because the other areas just seem like, well, we got all these guys that are going to rush the passer, and we've got these great corners, and the O-line's pretty nasty, and we can stretch the field. So we got a lot of things covered, but maybe the one area we don't necessarily have covered is the Travis Kelce area.
Yeah. I want to talk a little Bills here, Cynthia, because there is one thing that comes up from time to time with our fans, you know, that call into this show. And Steve and I have tried to kind of wrap our heads around why it is the case. Bills are a very prolific passing team, but they rank low almost every year in yards after catch. And we kind of suspect that it's partly due to the fact that Josh is kind of like a put it on you passer. He's not a throw you into space passer necessarily all the time. So we're thinking that's part of it. Is there a metric anywhere that can help spell out why, you know, the Bills typically rank very low in yards after catch as a team?
Well, a couple of things. First, if you're looking to see what kind of passes Josh throws, he throws deeper passes. So if you have longer air yards per attempt passes, it just takes longer for the play to develop. And it also becomes a deeper pass, which means sometimes you're already, like, I'd be curious to see, like, how many end up in the end zone, right? Because if you're only running 5 yards to get to the end zone, like, that's not a lot of yards right after the catch, because, you know, you made a touchdown. So the reality is he's throwing a bit deeper passes. And also, like, a lot of times it's smarter to run out of bounds, right? It's smarter to, you have to take into account the strategy of what you're trying to do there. It's not always just deep pass, yards after the catch, touchdown every single play. Sometimes clock management comes into play, and the score also. So I think it's kind of like a funny, weird statistical anomaly. I think the thing that matters more, way, way, way more, is earning first downs and touchdowns. And that's an area where the passing game for the Bills is always strong.
All right, so you're our favorite numbers nerd, and you came up with this thing. It's fun at this end of the season because we're just looking back, and we see all these teams that have had good seasons, bad seasons, unexpected seasons. You did a nice piece for the NFL.com about teams that aspects of teams that overperform. For instance, Seattle's passing offense with Geno was out of nowhere, right? And then you've also got stuff like Denver's offense that really underperformed. And I don't know if you can remember, you know, what you did in that, what you said in that piece, but can you give us maybe a couple of highs and lows, overs and unders of teams that you, because it's never predict. We're trying to predict all this stuff with analytics, and it's harder and harder. But some of these things came out of nowhere. These teams were either really good and we didn't expect them to be, or they really stunk and we expected them to be good.
So you talked about Geno Smith, and I kind of love this one because in the beginning of the season, he had the most deep touchdown passes of anyone in the entire league, which is funny for two reasons. One, it's Pete Carroll, who's notorious for saying, let's call a running play. How about you want to run the ball? Okay, let's run the ball again. The most rushing plays called by percentage any coach in like the last, in maybe like since people, you know, started passing the football, right? So that's funny too. It's just kind of something you didn't expect, because remember they traded for Drew Locke and everyone's like, it has to be Drew Locke, right? He's the starter. We didn't even think Geno was going to start. So that's where, that's a really fun one. And they don't even have a very good O-line. They do have two good wide receivers, and they're decent in the tight end game. But, you know, it was a fun one, especially, you know, given all the weird notes around, you know, the league about why maybe Russell left or whatever. And then, of course, because we saw them in preseason, it was strange to see the Broncos underperform so much on offense. Their defense was good. They were losing games, letting teams score less than double digits. And they lost games with Russell Wilson, who since his hand injury hasn't looked the same. You know, he's an he does a lot of improv, right? So all those, he couldn't really do that. He didn't get on the same page with his receivers. He has good receivers. Will be interesting to see what Sean Payton does, maybe a quicker passing, quicker strike offense like we saw with Drew Brees. I don't know. That's a huge contract. That seems like a difficult job. I'm glad a good coach got it because I like to see good football, but that was a very strange Broncos offense. Right. Strange.
Yeah, to say the least. Another question I had for you, Cynthia, was regarding all of the coordinator changes we've seen around the league. I realize we still got a game to play left in this season, but as you move into the offseason and begin to assess and kind of predict, you know, who might slot where in this league, you know, pecking order and whatnot, how much do you factor in new coordinators in new places and some of their previous history? I know the personnel that they inherit is obviously completely different, but Brian Flores to Minnesota, for example, do you look at his Dolphins history and maybe apply that in any way, shape, or form to your models, or Edgerow Evero in Carolina?
Yeah, I mean, the personnel matters the most, obviously, and the kind of coaching tree and the background. I mean, Minnesota specifically, I can speak a lot to Brian Flores. I actually went to college with Brian Flores randomly. I've known him for 20 years. And he obviously has a lot of experience with secondaries, which was the absolute problem with that Minnesota defense. Minnesota secondary, they're very young. They were very green. They weren't very good. They were giving up just so many passing yards. And so I think that will be a big source of improvement. Plus, with Kevin O'Connell's offensive style, it is a more important one because some of these coordinator positions, if they're not going to be really responsible for calling plays or making decisions, then they matter less. But in the case of the Vikings, absolutely, that one matters a ton. Also interesting to see, like, I'm curious to see what happens with Kellen Moore out here for the Chargers, because that's a good offense. Justin Herbert is a good quarterback and they have a lot of the pieces, but that team just keeps getting pummeled with injuries. And like the injury list is so long between them and the Titans that it's like, I don't even know what I'm looking at sometimes. So at the end of the day, I'll be interested to see how some of those guys make some adjustments, because I mean, you put a Schottenheimer in for the Cowboys, you know what you're getting there. It's going to be very traditional. It's going to be very, we'll see what the Cowboys can do. But at the end of the day, I think the coordinator positions this year are really fascinating because it does kind of also predict for the next wave of head coaches. So how they start to coordinate these games and what we start to see with offenses, considering how different the college game is. I'm getting into draft season and you just watch and the college game just keeps getting more and more different and distinct from the NFL game. And it's going to be interesting to see how they all kind of map going forward to these coordinators.
Yeah, the coordinators are kind of the big story this offseason because there are so many changing hands, like, you know, Kellen Moore going out and just going from one coordinator's job to another, Brian Flores reemerging as a defensive coordinator. You got Nate Hackett going from that coordinator's sideline, head coach for a half a year. Now he's a coordinator again for the New York Jets. Just what Brownie asked, you got Minnesota, who had a really nice offense, scored a lot of points, and won a lot of single-score games, but they were 31st in defense. Did they have the 31st roster in defense? I mean, they certainly had some better players. How do you quantify that, if you might give us some insight into that?
Yeah, so a lot, like, football is complementary, right? So if you have an offense like you have with the Minnesota Vikings, remember they were in all of those one possession games that you win, not super predictive because there could be one more possession and you could lose, right? So the interesting part there is you need things that fit, meaning if you're going to have that offense that's able to score all those points, you can't have a bad passing defense because teams, if you go up on them, they have to pass on you. So that is going to make it more and more difficult. And those numbers are going to look really inflated in the pass game if your weakness is what you're forcing other teams to do. The Vikings had Justin Jefferson, who obviously I hope he's the offensive player. I mean, he seems like he's a very strong candidate for offensive player of the year. But at the end of the day, it's like now you've got all these pass games. They didn't really have super consistent run games. Like Dalvin Cook showed up, didn't show up, showed up. Like wasn't because you cannot control the clock that way. So they have to fit together, which this is now where free agency becomes super important. So you get your coordinators into position and then you see how you're going to restock the shelves. It's going to be fascinating for the Jets to see what they do, right? Because Nathaniel Hackett obviously came from that Green Bay pedigree with a quarterback who is, you know, amongst the most serious, focused, and knows what he wants in the league. Now, you don't know what's going on at quarterback there, right? You know, that Russell Wilson, we're just going to, that's an asterisk. We'll move that over there. We'll give him the Aaron Rodgers credit that he deserves. And then now, who are they going to get to do that job? Because if you bring in a younger person or even a free agent, they could not have that personality. So it's going to be very interesting to see the teams that fit the best are the ones where the guys bring in from free agency and draft the people who could execute the game plan and vision of the coaches, coordinators, whoever's in charge of actually calling the plays. We'll see how they all fit together.
Awesome. Cynthia, thanks for all the insight. We appreciate it. We also understand you have a new roommate. Care to share real quick?
He's the cutest ever. He's kind of messy and he's very needy. He is my puppy and he's about 8 months old and I rescued him. His name is Gordy after Gordy Howe. And I couldn't love him anymore. And I'm very like sad to leave him for the Super Bowl. I'm going tomorrow and we're having a moment here. Him and I, we'll pull it together, but you know, we're going to go on an extra walk, maybe some extra treats. We'll be okay.
That's right. Awesome.
That's great.
Congratulations.
Thanks, Cynthia. Again, we'll catch up with you soon here in the off season.
Yes, can't wait to see you guys soon.
All right, that's NFL Network's analytics expert Cynthia Freeland joining us there. And she kind of made me feel better about the yards after the catch situation with the Bills, because a lot of people knock the Bills for not having a high yards after catch figure. I think they were second to last in 21. This past season, they were fifth from the bottom. And I don't think it really impacts their scoring prowess, their ability to move the football. And Cynthia kind of confirmed that for me. What the Bills do well is they can throw the ball deep because of Josh. That can reduce opportunities in terms of yards after the catch. And I think she confirmed for us what matters is first downs and touchdowns when it comes to prolific offense. And the Bills score very highly in those two areas. And so yards after the catch, yeah, it'd be nice to have, but it's not killing them. I mean, just look at their numbers.
Right.
At least the numbers that count, scoring.
That's right, scoring and yards and first downs and third down conversion. They're really good at that. I mean, so they're clicking on a lot of cylinders. And, you know, despite how the season ended for them, there's a lot to build on with the guys. And, you know, I know that in the recency bias that we all live under, I mean, we all think about the team and how it looked when they walked off the field this last, you know, month. When they got beat and they didn't play well, and you tend to want to scrap a few things and try something else. I don't know that I would. You got to take a deep breath and just get those guys to play better on that day. Now, certainly they had a lot of things working against them. So did, you know, the Bengals did too. I don't know that we'll ever be able to quantify the effect that DeMar Hamlin's injury had on them, because the Bills won the next two games. But they barely beat
sloppy against
they barely
Miami.
Beat the New England Patriots.
Yeah, and sloppy against Miami.
Very sloppy against Miami. Skylar Thompson almost beat him, and they needed two kickoff returns for touchdowns to beat the Patriots, and Patriots were putrid offensively.
Yeah.
So I don't think they ever recovered from that this season. I think it was painfully obvious, although not evident. In the game against Cincinnati, because it seemed like it was getting further away from what DeMar had been through, and I just don't think the team was the same. I don't know, though. It's not for me to speculate about that, except that's what I do on the radio, speculate. So it's easy to sit here and say, man, we need to change this, we need to change that, let's go here, let's do that. I don't know. I'm not ready to do that. Josh is a player that you got to build around, and that means the offense is going to look a certain way. And as we heard Cynthia say, he throws the ball all over the yard. It's not about yards after catch. It's about first downs and touchdowns and third downs and converting third downs. And they're really good at that. They're still an almost really tough team to beat.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of with her. And some of our callers have said the same thing. You know, they got some faith in the guys they got on the team, but you need to protect Josh up front.
Right, which brings us back to an offense that at times probably became almost too Josh-centric and depended on him making something miraculous happen, you know, to give them or put them in a situation to score points.
Yeah.
So what's the most effective way to make maybe take the load off of Josh, even just a little bit, going into 2023. We get back to the phones, and waiting patiently has been Dave in West Seneca. What do you got for us, Dave? You're on One Bills Live.
Hey, guys. Hey, I'm a 40-year season ticket holder, and I've seen a lot of good and bad with this team, so I'm very proud of this team, so don't get me wrong. Hey, I'm thinking when we played Cincinnati in that playoff game and we went down 14-0, I looked at my wife and my nephew that was sitting next to me, and I said, they're going to put this game on Josh's shoulders. I said, and I looked at him, I said, I feel sorry for the kid. I said, they just put too much on his back, and I think he knows that he's carrying the weight of this team on his back, and I feel sorry for him. But I think what they need help is the inside of the offensive line. You need two brand-new guards. If you look at the three previous games that you were just talking about, the New England, Miami, and Cincinnati game, Josh had no time back there to sit back there and look at his second, third, fourth receivers. I mean, he had no time whatsoever. Whatever they're doing defensively, they knew they can beat up on our offensive line, and they came after us with everything they had, and we had no answer for it. So I think we need two offensive guards, and I think they need to. And I think you can get that in the free agency without paying too much. But I think you also need to draft a center, because one more concussion, maybe two, with Mitch Morse, and you're going to be looking for another center. So I think they need to let's develop another center, and let's get two new guards to help Josh, and maybe one receiver. And I think you can get that in the draft also to keep our salary cap down low. So thanks, guys. Like the show, and I'll listen to what you have to say.
Yeah, I'll say this too, and you're right, Dave. When they get into a tight spot, they do depend on Josh. That's what teams do with guys like Josh on them, like Mahomes, like Burrow, like Justin Herbert, and even Jacksonville with Trevor Lawrence, Brady and Aaron Rodgers. That's what teams do. When you got that guy, that's what he's there for.
Part of the gig.
And you don't need to feel sorry for him. Guys like Josh and Mahomes and Aaron, they love it.
They want it.
They want the ball in their hands when the game is on the line late, when something's got to happen. They don't want anybody else to have the ball. So don't feel sorry for those guys. It's a gift. It's a gift, and they treat it as such. That's why they're good. They love moments like that. Whether they succeed or fail, they still want us to take the swing. They still want to take that snap and see what happens. So don't feel sorry for him. And Josh is not the only guy in the league who the team asks a ton of, like I just said. Mahomes had 91% of the Kansas City offense in the championship game. 91%. He was the guy. So you can say what you want about how much the Bills ask him to do. If you can give him some help, awesome, yeah. But that's the way it works in the NFL.
Right. And maybe it's, and we probably said this earlier already, but it's just about making life a little bit easier for him. Whether it's, as some of our callers have pointed out, a half second longer to throw, you know, and deliver the football.
One more open guy.
Yeah. A guy that can get early separation more consistently, you know, for easy button throws, as we've talked about. Whatever it is, you got to invest on that side to help the best player on your team. Make it easier for him so he can excel even more frequently than he already does.
Yeah. He's still going to be the center of everything. And if the offensive line's better, all that stuff, yeah, no question about it. But he's still going to have to be the guy that sees the open man and makes that throw. He's going to be the one making the decisions back here, and that's what quarterbacks do. They make decisions and they execute it. So another year with him and Ken Dorsey, they're going to be smoother and better. They're going to learn about each other and learn more about what they're doing and some of the things they can do better. And they'll slice it up way more than we'll ever be able to here on this radio program. But I'm with you. Offensive line looks to be something that you can say this about the receivers and stuff, about they drop too many passes or whatever. That's obvious. That's something we all know how to fix. He's get those guys out there and catch balls all day, and you get to where you don't drop any. You drop fewer. Offensive line, it's harder for, you know, everyday schmucks like me and Brownie to think, well, how do they get better? They get bigger? Are they stronger? Okay, those guys lift and they train all the time. How do they play better? And there's no question offensive linemen play better in one system than another, and there's ways for them to improve their play. But for most of us, Jamokes, like me, you think, well, gosh, just get better players. And there is some of that going on with the Bills today and all the calls we've been having and the conversation that's been going on since the end of the season, where you just feel like you need to be more dominant up there. That is a different conversation than having receivers who can just catch more balls and get better. How much improvement guys like Spencer Brown can make, Ryan Bates, Mitch Morris, how much better can Deion Dawkins and Roger Saffold get?
And how confident you are that's going to happen. You can project it. What's your degree of confidence, though, is just as important, because that's going to determine whether or not you purchase an insurance plan.
Right. Younger players tend to get a higher ceiling credited to them, whether it's there or not. Guys like Roger Saffold, who's in week 20, like this last week, he was in week 20 of year 13. You kind of know what you're going to get with Roger Saffold. And that may be enough. But if you've got a guy that may be give you more than that, you might roll the dice on the guy. You know, a draft pick or a free agent or whoever. Yeah. But at least with Roger Saffold, you know where the floor is, and you can help him and do things, and you know what you can ask of him. And it gives you some confidence in those things. A young guy gives you less confidence in everything, but maybe a chance to get better in all those things.
Yeah.
That's where we're at.
That's the balance.
Yeah.
We got to take a break here, but when we come back, we're going to crack open the tweet sheet, get some more of your thoughts on how you think the Bills in 2023 might be able to lighten Josh Allen's load and make things easier for him just a little bit. We're back here in a moment on One Bills Live, presented by Kalida Health. It's Buffalo Bills Radio. All right, welcome back to One Bills Live. Chris Brown, Steve Tasker with you, asking you what's the most effective way to take the load off Josh Allen next season, make things a little easier for him. And for answers, we can only go to one place, the tweet sheet. Brought to you by Corrigan Moving Systems, the official equipment moving specialists of the Buffalo Bills.
Every question you've ever wanted to know, if you ask it,
it's like
Twitter,
a magic 8-ball.
That's right.
I mean, it is.
It will always come up with an answer.
Yes. Prospects look cloudy. Yeah, Anthony leads us off and says, bring in competition for right tackle. But I'm hoping Spencer Brown makes a jump having a full off season. Find a new right guard and move Bates back to left guard. And hopefully Shakir can be more of a true number two or get one. So it sounds like Anthony is hopeful that certain players can take another step that are already on the roster. But it sounds like he wants insurance plans in place.
It's like every, yeah, and it's an adage. If you can get a player that's better than the one you got, particularly if it's cheaper, get it. And if it's not cheaper, how much more expensive is it going to be?
Right.
But you need to bring in guys at every position to make these guys better or to get better, a better guy. That's it.
Foster better competition, and maybe that guy does take an extra step.
Coaches are all about that, and I think for the most part, players are too. They're not afraid of it.
Yeah, most players at this level, you can't be.
You've
met every level of competition that's been thrown at you.
That's right, and that's what it should be.
Kenny on the tweet sheet says, I haven't seen an executed screen pass in 6 years. I'm guessing he's talking about a traditional screen. The offense needs to deliver some layups to Josh. It can't be a three-step drop in shotgun every single play. I would agree with that. It'd be nice to see a traditional screen show up every now and again. For some reason, it proved to be a monumental task for this offense for whatever reason. Now, they ran different kinds of screens, mostly out in space, you know, of the bubble screen variety with a receiver or even a back lined up wide, and they would execute them that way. Occasionally, you'd see like one of those slip screens or something, or a tight end screen even once in a while.
Yes, yeah, but usually the quick screen to the wide side or whatever.
Yeah, but it was, even that was a mixed bag in terms of effectiveness. So for whatever reason, it was a chore for them to execute screens. And as such, they didn't call a lot of them.
Yeah, I've always said, you know, you do what people give you to do. I mean, you take what the defense gives you. when you got a quarterback like Josh, the defense doesn't rush you the same as they do if you're
that
Joe Burrow or if you're whatever. They don't rush Pat Mahomes that way. You know, the Chiefs run a ton of those shovel passes, particularly down in the red zone. They run that a lot. Those don't seem to work as well for Buffalo because when Josh drops back to pass, he drops back to pass. He doesn't really run off. They don't roll him out. A lot of teams don't want that to happen anyway, so they do that. Plus, teams have stopped rushing past Josh. So, you know, those defensive ends, when Josh drops back, even if he's under center, drops back five steps, seven steps, the ends come off the edges around both left tackle and right tackle. They have stopped, except in certain situations, that most of the time they stop where Josh stops.
At the top of his drop.
They stop at the top of Josh's drop. They don't go past him, so they don't open up a lane between the defensive tackle and the defensive end where the end's all the way past Josh and the tackle's up here at the line of scrimmage. So Josh just moves out to that way. There's a big screen. They stop doing that. That takes away any chance to run a screen pass.
So, too, does all the times that he sees a spy out there. There's an extra defender just sitting there, and if you're running a screen pass – when they have a spy for Josh on a certain down and distance, guess what? They got an extra defender sitting there waiting to go attack the football.
And I'll say this, too. You would think in this regard that you'd be able to run more screens because teams are hesitant to run man coverage against the Bills because you got the receivers running up and the defensive backs are running with their backs to Josh looking at the receiver, and Josh just pull it down and chase him. Right, he just runs it for snaps off a 26-yard run. They don't want that to happen, particularly since Josh can get away from most spies. But that means that teams play more zone, and it's usually that's when you run screen passes. Because if you got man coverage, somebody's on the back that you're going to throw the screen to. He just gets up and he's all in the middle of the screen pass.
Yeah,
and it's hard for the offensive lineman to back up, let their guy go, and then get that guy before he's right in where you're trying to throw the pass. So you would think in that respect, seeing more zone would give you a chance to run more screens. It has not worked out that way. Like I said, the pass rush has changed and evolved around Josh where these guys don't run past him. And teams are just more – for whatever reason, maybe – we thought maybe it was because they didn't have athletic or mobile offensive linemen. Mitch Morse is out running out around the end. He's mobile enough to get out there.
So is Deion.
And so is Deion. But I think it has more to do with the fact that Josh Allen's your quarterback and these defenses are looking at him and they play him differently. And one of the byproducts of that is if you're going to run a screen, Josh has got to throw it quick right now instead of dropping back and then dropping back a little more and then dumping it. I just don't think that's conducive to the way teams play against Josh Allen. I don't think it has to do with the offensive line. I think it has to do with Josh.
Ryan on the tweet sheet says, Maulers in the run game so we can run the football without Josh Allen. A wide receiver, too, that can get separation. A running back that can tote the ball 22 times for 120 yards, utilizing James Cook in the pass game more. I like some of those things, Ryan, but I don't know if you're ever going to see a running back, unless it is a blinding snowstorm with driving wind, run 22 times in a game. I think the Bills, even when they do run the football, do it in a committee fashion, and whether Devin Singletary is here or not next year, knowing he's a free agent, it would be Cook and Hines splitting the load.
I would be okay with most of that, except I want a running back that carries it 15 times for 80 yards, 85 yards. That's what I would rather have. I don't want anybody having it 22 times running it, unless you're ahead by unless you're ahead by 25 or 28 points and it's the second half of the game. Then okay, fine, give him the ball 30 times, but. Yeah, it's just not the most efficient way to move the football. And I get it. It makes fans feel warm and safe when you got a running game. You just hand it off all day and just, you know, it's 6 yards here, 6 yards there, first down. 6 yards here, 3 yards here, and 4 yards there. It's another first down. Let's just keep handing it off. It looks so easy, and it takes all the stress out of it. I get it, but that's never going to happen, ever.
It's good to have when you have the lead, though. If you are up, it's a good way to shorten the game. so to speak. It's not the most efficient way to score points, but it is an efficient way to kill a game, shorten it, and keep the clock moving, which is Mark's point here on the tweet sheet, who says running game to keep defenses honest, that will help with game and clock management, make Josh running harder to deal with by virtue of having, you know, a productive running attack that doesn't just involve Josh, it involves actual running backs. Totally get it. And if you can have a running game that you can turn to, whether your pass game's out of sync or whether you want to kill a game because you're up by 17, having that would be nice.
Yeah, but, yes, it would. But that doesn't mean just because you're up 25 points doesn't mean you can't
keep doing what you've been doing to get there in the
doing
first place.
What you're doing. Yeah,
it's more risky though, as we learned this year.
Yeah, so it's not. No, it's not. It's more risky than handing it off every time, but it's also more probable that you're going to make that first down. So, if you want to do that, that's fine. I just as soon keep playing offense, and that's what nobody is willing to do. And I don't know why.
Yeah,
play. I don't know. You know. Don't stop doing what gave you a 25-point lead.
Yeah, don't hide from it.
Don't run off and hide. Play. I know it's easy to say that hypothetically, but good grief. I mean, we got to one point. I was watching these games. We got to one point this last year in the Pittsburgh game where, you know, Case Keenum's on the field, you know, just for kicks and giggles. So, yeah, I just play. I don't need a running game in case we get up.
Yeah.
If we get up, what do we need the running game for? Come on. So I get it. It's pretty frustrating. What's really frustrating, you go out there and throw three incompletions and go three and out. Yeah, I get that. But man, oh man.
Yeah. It's a good dilemma to have, but we have to take a break here. When we come back, some final thoughts on the tweet sheet here on One Bills Live, presented by Kaleida Health. This is Buffalo Bills Radio. All right, some final thoughts on the tweet sheet here. Paul says, adding weapons around him while supplying a good offensive line so he's not always running around in the pocket and force something down the field. Phillip says, easy scheme throws, screens and play action, quick throws that get yards after the catch, should include more targets for slot, knocks, and running backs, improved O-line that allows for running game to truly attack the weak side, make teams defend sideline to sideline. Danielle says, line, yes, we have weapons, though. Diggs, Davis, Cook, Knox, et cetera, should be getting the job done. Maybe better play calling, ? Buffalo guy, O-line upgrades, getting the run game more involved. If we have a running back that Josh trusts to get the tough yards, it might help with the workload that he shoulders. And Ronald says, a stud running back.
Boom! All right.
Easy peasy.
Oh, I'm telling you, good players make you better. The Bills have got their work cut out for them, getting all these guys into training camp. That's going to be the job going forward. And we'll just, you know, sit and watch them. All this stuff is good. They're going to have 85 guys going into training camp. It's going to be fun to see them compete and see if they can get better.
Yeah, and, you know, people talk about, oh, we need this in the draft. We need that in the draft. Don't forget, free agency comes first. And as we know, Brandon Bean likes to cross off as many positional holes as he can before he even gets to the draft. So, you know, he can draft truly the way he wants to, which is better, best player available. But
good stuff.
That's it for us today. We'll see you back here. Same bat time, same bat channel. We'll see you at 1:00.